You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Minjin Lee has won several awards for her essays in short fiction, and her first novel, Free Food for Millionaires, was a national bestseller. She's followed that now with a new novel called Pachinko that explores the long history of discrimination against Koreans living in Japan in the 20th century and follows the story of a family spanning five generations and its struggle with finding a homeland. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, and I'm very pleased it has brought Minjin Lee to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You begin your novel with Japan's annexation of Korea in 1910. How did life change for Koreans after that event?
You know, after 1910, the Koreans in Japan, the Koreans in Korea essentially became colonial members of Japan.
Did it matter whether they were living in what became North or South Korea?
Well, North and South Korea didn't really occur until...
I understand.
Right.
But as I understand it, the Japanese put a lot more industry in the North, which actually affected relations between the two countries once there was the separation after World War II.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, a lot of revisionist historians often look at that event of the annexation as a positive thing for Korea because it added industry and electricity and railroads, especially in the northern areas.
Who are the Zainichi?
The Zainichi are, it's kind of a misnomer for a term of people who are the Korean Japanese. Zainichi actually means foreign residents staying in Japan. The problem with that term that some historians take umbrage with is the fact that many Korean Japanese have been there for four generations or more.
They moved during the time that Korea was a colony of Japan.
Exactly.
And then established themselves as Japanese. Think of themselves as Japanese?
I think they do think of themselves as Japanese, but they're not allowed to think of themselves as Japanese. And that's the real conundrum.
Who's Sunja? Why did she move from Korea to Japan?
So Sunja is ahistorical in the way most historians represent the Korean-Japanese story because she actually goes there because she falls in love with an older man who's married. She becomes pregnant. And then he can't marry her, obviously. So she decides to marry somebody else who's kind to her, who's a missionary. And then she goes to Osaka and she becomes fully Korean-Japanese without having had the intention to do so.
You've named this novel after a game, Pachinko. Why choose that for the title of the book?
Oh, well, pachinko is a $190 billion industry in Japan. So it's twice the export revenues of Japan. The reason why I named it pachinko is because it's such an important industry in Japan, and it's dominated and owned mostly by the Korean-Japanese community, who ended up flocking towards this industry because the Korean-Japanese couldn't find legal employment elsewhere or become middle-class people. So then they entered into this sort of industry that was considered a very organized, crime-heavy industry.
It's like a pinball machine.
Exactly. It's a game. It's a gambling industry, but it's for adults.
And you, as somebody who lives here, you had to research this? Is all of the material readily available?
No. As a matter of fact, I lived in Japan from 2007 to 2011. And in those years, I met a lot of Korean Japanese and I interviewed dozens upon dozens of Korean Japanese people.
When you're doing your research, what was the most surprising thing you learned about the Korean diaspora?
I think one of the most surprising things was feeling that they are so different from the Korean Americans. And I'm a Korean American. I came here when I was 7 and a half, and I grew up in Queens, New York. I feel very much like a New Yorker and an American. I feel very normal here.
But Queens, if you grow up in the Korean area of Queens, you could probably live your whole life speaking Korean.
Yeah, I think I
never
could.
Speak English and get along perfectly well.
I have relatives who basically don't speak that much English. So you're completely correct because you don't have to. You can actually just go to Korean churches, Korean businesses, and sort of stay there. You work for American people, not necessarily Koreans, but then you could end up not learning English.
But there are, in some ways, Korean language, for example, has more similarities to Western languages in that it relies on an alphabet.
That's correct.
Whereas the Japanese are using Chinese characters to apply to a language that seems to have little in common with the written language.
You know, it's really interesting because Korean is easiest to learn of the East Asian languages because it has an alphabet directly.
What, 30 characters or something
I think it's 28 or 26. I'm blanking right now. Never been on the Leonard Lopate show before. But what's interesting is that they do, on higher-level academic texts, they do use Hanmun, which is a part Chinese characters. So you do have to know a certain amount of Chinese characters.
Your novel deals with struggles of identity. I'm sure the audience is already kind of figuring that out. How does Senja's children, Noah and Mosasu, is it, differ in their relationships to their with their Korean identities?
Well, because they're born in Japan, they are culturally Japanese. However, they're also culturally Korean Japanese because the Korean Japanese are pretty much segregated at that period in history. They were forced to live in ghettos. They're almost like shanty towns, and they weren't allowed to have regular middle class jobs like becoming postal workers or nurses or teachers.
And were they always faced with the possibility of deportation?
Yes, until about 1993, that's when the fingerprinting laws changed. And then there are also...
1993,
the fingerprinting.
That recently?
Yes. Yes. Until then, they had to be fingerprinted. And that was considered a great insult because in Japan, to be fingerprinted at that time for about 40-plus years was only for criminals.
Mosasu's son, Solomon, has to deal with the threat of deportation to Korea when he's just 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Does he feel connected to his Korean roots?
Oh, not at all. Because most people who are actually born in Japan, who are of ethnic Korean heritage, when they do go back to Korea, they're not considered Korean. They're considered Japanese, and they're kind of considered almost like betrayers.
Even though, in many cases, they had no choice. They just...
They're completely accidents
of history.
Were brought
to Japan.
Yes.
There are also some pretty famous Japanese people who grew up in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Toshio Mifune, the great Japanese film star, spent much of his youth in Korea.
That makes sense, yeah.
What was... So Solomon winds up with the British Investment Bank. Are foreign companies a way to get around the discrimination against Koreans?
I think that there's a kind of misplaced idea that... I mean, it's really tragic because when Solomon is Moses's son, and Moses is Sanja's son, so this is the fourth generation in, and he believes that because his father has money and is educated at Columbia University, when he goes back to Japan, he thinks that by working at a British investment bank, he'll be treated well. Mm-hmm. However, of course, he isn't. And that's really sad because there's a wish that somehow the Japanese who are in charge, even at Western banks, will treat you kindly. But no one ever seems to forget that you're ethnically Korean, even today.
My guest is Min Jin Lee, whose second novel is Pachinko. And so you say you lived in Japan for how many years?
4 years.
And you felt that discrimination the whole time?
No, actually it was kind of funny because I felt it occasionally. Like I would forget because I was, you know, mostly with expatriates. I was interviewing many Korean Japanese and Japanese people. However, I feel like an American. But once in a while I would have certain encounters with people like my Japanese landlord.
Well, Japanese expats tell me that when they go back, they are spotted right away as being American, not as Japanese, even though they may have been born in Japan, by the way they walk, the way they talk. Were you spotted immediately as an outsider?
Well, first of all, I'm really tall, so I tend to stand out a bit, get wanted or unwanted attention consequently. But I think that what was interesting to me was being an expatriate, very often I would essentially walk around like an observer because I'm an Asian person in an Asian country and people can't necessarily tell, I don't think. However, I would have certain encounters where, let's say, for example, with a Japanese landlord, I would complain about a leak in a ceiling and they would say something like, oh, you're complaining because Koreans like to complain.
Oh.
I know. It was really weird because I always think of Asian Americans, this big tent that I sort of fall under, as a group that doesn't complain that much. So I thought, oh, wait, hang on. I'm really surprised. So that was kind of like that kind of thing would happen now and then. I would be reminded that I have Korean blood because blood is a very important thing in Japan.
And so is religion, obviously.
Mm. Yeah, religion.
Koreans, are there a lot of Christians in Korea? Not too
a
many
lot
in
of
Japan.
Christians. Well, in Japan, Christianity is seen as a cult. So very educated people will think that you are in a cult if you're a Christian.
Well, if you're a member of Sum Myung Moon's Christian group, you are a member of a cult.
That is a cult, absolutely. But
but
he's not
but
really
all Christians
yeah.
are seen as members of a cult?
I'm Presbyterian, which is probably the most boring Protestant sect. And I was actually asked by a very educated person, well, isn't Presbyterianism a cult? And I thought, really? That's new.
Well, religion plays an important role in Korean politics as well. Mm-hmm, doesn't mm-hmm. The current political crisis involve the daughter of a spiritual leader?
Right. And she is a member of a cult. And there's a shamanistic element involved in that one. And that was really troubling for most people in Korea.
How does Sunja's husband, Isaac Baek, struggle with religion and politics?
Well, I think that he really didn't want to get involved in the politics. He was very involved in the religious aspect of it. But one of the things that should be known about Korean history is that the principal architects of the resistance against the Japanese colonialism era were Presbyterian ministers who came out of Pyongyang, which is the principal seminary of Korea.
We go through a bunch of different generations, so things change.
Sure.
This tension between familial and romantic love mm-hmm. throughout this book. You also have included a number of explicit sexual encounters. What role did you intend for sex to play in telling this story?
One of the things that I really found interesting about the lives of the poor, and these are very poor people for a very long time, and they are an oppressed minority. However, they found great consolation in love, whether it's family love or romantic love. And it was interesting for me to interview people when they did talk about sex and failed love. And people were quite forthcoming about their love lives in my interviews.
Now, are marriages arranged in Korea in the same way that they are in Japan? Among the Koreans?
Yeah, for much of the history of Japan and Korea, arranged marriages are considered to be good things. And I do understand why. Because, you know, you have this idea of families having good intentions and seeing what will work with each other.
Your novel spans over 70 years. Would you say that the struggles that these people face change from generation to generation?
I do think that they change, but I think what's really upsetting to me still is just how Koreans, no matter how many generations there are considered to be outsiders.
And that's even today?
That's absolutely even today.
Exile is another recurring theme in the novel. But these are people who are experiencing exile sometimes on a much more of a mental level than on a physical level.
Huh, I like that a lot. Yeah, I do think so. And what's weird about this exile is that they actually don't have a home anymore because the Korea in their minds doesn't even exist anymore.
Before you became a full-time writer, weren't you a lawyer?
I was a lawyer.
do you think that your experience in law has informed your writing?
I do. I think so because I think lawyers are trained to think more logically or to focus on the issues and to be less emotional about the facts. And I think sometimes I was able to be a bit more distant with what happens, especially the things that weren't fair. In my interviews, I'm able to be a lot more objective, I think, because I was once a lawyer.
First sentences are always important to a novel. Yours is, history had failed us, but no matter.
I think that line for me was the thesis of the entire book. I feel like history has failed most of us, regular people. And yet, because the story is incomplete and because things are unfair, most of history is decided without us being at the table. But what I really notice in all of my interviews is that regular people persist anyway. And they care about the things that regular people care about, like families and feeding their families and putting a roof over their heads.
You talk about your interviews. Were you interviewing in preparation for this novel, which, as I understand, is actually going to be expanded into a trilogy? Or mm-hmm. were you doing journalism as well?
I was doing some journalism for Condé Nast publications and other kinds of publications like Wall Street Journal, New York Times. But then I also was primarily thinking about this book, Pachinko, for my interviews. And I did very long, exhaustive interviews because I think that I kind of want to be a journalist, but of course I can't do it. It's just too difficult.
But journalists admire you because your debut novel, Free Food for Millionaires, was one of the top 10 novels of the year for the Times of London, but also NPR's Fresh Air, Terry Gross, mm-hmm. USA Today. Short fiction has been featured on NPR's Selected Shorts, and you've written travel mm-hmm. pieces as well for Condé Nast Traveler.
Mm-hmm. I have.
And now a second novel, one of three.
Yes.
How far are you into the other two?
Oh, so Free Food for Millionaires, my first book, was about the Koreans in America. So Pachinko is about the Koreans in Japan.
So this is number two.
Yes. So my third one is called American Hagwon, which I, right now I'm kind of like doodling and sketching out, and I'm doing interviews, and that's about the role of education for Koreans around the world.
Pachinko is published by Grand Central Publishing, and my great thanks to Min Jin Lee for stopping by to talk about it.
Oh, thank you so much.